TFM.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I really wish you'd start doing something. I mean, you've really been laying down on the job recently, and this station isn't going to fix itself.
Superman frame station lamp.
Is this like $25,000 pyramid we're playing here? Or what is that?
Cup, gun, hug, pillow.
What are new emojis coming in iOS 17?
Cup, hug, gun, pillow.
I better get you to the infirmary while I let everyone know that we are going to be continuing our 30th anniversary rewatch of Star Trek Deep Space Nine today. We're going to be talking about the fourth episode of the series, Babel. And while Matthew recovers there, I'll give you a quick synopsis of the episode. When lazy Chief O'Brien gets a hankering for a cup of coffee and triggers a booby trap left behind from the occupation, station crew and residents begin losing their ability to make sense one by one. As aphasia sweeps the station, Kira must find a Bajoran scientist who may hold the key to an antidote and saving everyone before Cross Barrels, all job appalled, bread the arrive seen earlier. Matthew, I think it's happening to me now as well. I hope we can get through the show today.
I do too. So quickly, are your thoughts?
Quickly. It was a pretty good episode, and everyone, we'd love to hear your thoughts.
That's all the time we have for the show.
Exactly, right. So why don't we just start with the premise of this one, because watching this episode, you get the feeling that this could happen on any Star Trek series. It doesn't have to be Deep Space Nine, and we are at the beginning of the first season, and sometimes we talk about how the show is trying to find its identity and find its voice as it's stepping out of the shadows of TNG. And in this one in particular, it actually is the case. Michael Piller said that this was a premise that they had for an episode for more than 5 years on The Next Generation, and they had never turned it into an actual episode. And definitely, it is something that I could see happening aboard the Enterprise D.
Mm-hmm. I think this absolutely could happen on the Enterprise D, and it could probably happen in any Star Trek series. Actually, I do think the series this would make the most sense in is actually a Voyager as opposed to Deep Space Nine, mm-hmm. because the gel packs allow you to do those
True.
Type of things very easily.
Yeah.
And like them having a virus, then creating a virus seems to make sense. We should be writing Star Trek, Chris. But the thing that I think they did so well here is that they tied this into the story of Deep Space Nine. This season, of course, we've started with Bajor being freed from the Cardassian rule. And, we know about the resistance. Of course, Kira was in the resistance, and their resistance against the Cardassians, especially on the station. We're well aware of all of that. And we also know the state that the station was left in. And so the fact that there are these leftover booby traps that tie into the Cardassian occupation, to me, 100% make this, yes, you could find a way to write this into any show.
Mm-hmm.
But this is another place where I felt like they made it specific to Deep Space Nine enough mm-hmm. that you're like, no, this actually very much works. And I think the beauty of that is that it allows our characters to go through a very traumatizing experience together, which, you know, as we move forward in the season, it'll be interesting to see how this connects them more, because mm-hmm. they have to learn to trust each other very quickly in this episode.
Yeah. 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 It does work well to build that bond among the crew, which is important at this point in the story, not only because it's early first season for us as viewers, but the characters themselves are just coming together aboard the station. I think I would describe it maybe the reverse of what you said, where as opposed to you could find a way to write this into any series, I think that you could write this into any series and they found a way to write it into DS9. So just kind of a nuance of,
mm-hmm.
because yep. the concept is so universal. I mean, it could work on any science fiction show. It doesn't even have to be Star Trek. But the fact that they tied it into the occupation is great, and it makes sense for the most part. Although I was thinking that if you put this virus on the station, maybe you incapacitate all the Cardassians aboard Terok Nor, but you've still got Cardassians on the planet. You've still got mm-hmm. Cardassians right. everywhere. So I suppose that the idea might be that they would spread the virus to the other Cardassians when mm-hmm. like a rescue right. party comes. But as we see in this episode, it doesn't only affect Cardassians. And so
right.
it even affects Bajorans. So I don't know that they really thought through their plan very well when they created this virus and mm-hmm. put it there on the station.
Yeah.
But I suppose they had some kind of plan 18 years earlier when they actually did it.
Well, and to me, that's one of those places where I think that they did think this through pretty well, because in many ways, the Resistance planning this, you're not necessarily always thinking clearly,
mm-hmm.
and therefore not having put into thought, okay, does this affect us as Bajorans? And what if this gets out on Bajor?
Right.
We could, you know, completely destroy an entire planet. And we are left with the idea that, yes, the creator of this probably did have an antidote to it, but of course he died.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are left in this place to which, if that hadn't happened and this had gotten loose, they would have maybe been able to hold the station ransom or mm-hmm. something, or that kind of thing. So I think there's a lot of different ways this can play out. Of course, we're left in this area where, yeah, the creator of this virus is dead, and that cuts off and negates a lot of the usefulness to this. And so I like exactly your point, because mm-hmm. it's like, I don't know if this is all as well thought through as maybe it yeah. should have been thought through. Well, and maybe it was, but of course we don't get that side of the story. That's
yeah.
that's not
yeah.
where we're able to go here.
I have a feeling it probably wasn't. It was like, hey, here's a good idea. We can plant this thing on the station and we can pass aphasia or something that mimics it on to the Cardassians. And then the ore processing will stop, and then I don't know what we do from there. In talking about how it mirrors the real world, though, you look at biological weapons. You have nations that
right.
create biological weapons and chemical weapons. I think biological weapons are maybe a better parallel to what's going on here, where there's the thought of, well, we could use these. But it's always short-sighted, because we're all human beings. We all have the same biology.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be tiny, tiny differences in genes and DNA amongst different races. But pretty much if you develop a biological weapon, we're all going to be susceptible to it, right? So if you use it, it's a very short-sighted way of trying to gain advantage over an enemy. And
yeah, it's like we've seen that play out recently.
Yeah, right. So it's not necessarily what the episode's talking about, but it is a parallel that is there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As far as like finding the scientist who might be able to come up with an antidote goes, it's another example here, right at the beginning of season one, where Kira has such a big role to play. There's so much character development for her. And also she's being forced to look back at the tactics of how the people that she was fighting with were approaching the occupation, mm-hmm. which in the moment she understandably saw as being a necessary means to an mm-hmm. end. But in her current position, yes. and now that the Cardassians are gone, she's really having to look at herself and rethink these things and then find a new path. And this is another case where even though the overall story might be kind of generic, they're really giving a good moment for Kira to have to do that.
Yes. No, I 100% agree with you. And I think that that's, again, one of the strengths here of Deep Space Nine is even in this first season, these first few episodes, what we're seeing here is that the writers are able to take things to which, yes, you could use on any science fiction show, specifically Star Trek, and yet they are giving it that Deep Space Nine flavor to which makes it work best here, I think, on this show. And like you said, the way that this touches on so many different themes and elements that we've already been talking about in the first season, specifically Kira and her facing of, you know, how the Resistance fought their war, is fantastic. And, you know, if there's anything that the episode could do better, it's probably to give us a moment where that is more brought to the forefront. Otherwise, you know, I think that this, by playing with this idea of leftover booby traps, you know, this one being here from the Resistance, also leads to other stories that we're going to get there down the road where this happens again. But that time it's a Cardassian booby trap. And so I think it also goes to show, too, just the difference between the way in which these different races handle things opposite of the way we would expect Starfleet officers and Federation mm-hmm. People to do, right? Mm-hmm. There's a juxtaposition there between the way and the life that these people have led that lead them to this. And that's actually kind of the beauty of this story here, because when I think about, as we move all the way, you know, forward in the series towards the Dominion War, that's the beauty of the Dominion War, right? Is it begins to ask those questions about, well, when push comes to shove, what are people in the Federation willing to do mm-hmm. to survive? Yeah. And so by laying these questions as a foundation of the show here in an episode like this, we then are able to ask those questions later on of our Starfleet characters and the Federation in a way that feels very cohesive to the world of Deep Space Nine, and then enriches the entire Star Trek universe, because as we've talked about many times, is that we are testing the limits of the creation of Star Trek and its presuppositions, especially as given to us by TNG.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And the tit for tat between the Cardassians and the Bajorans with this kind of thing represents a lot more who we are today. It's the kind of thing that we would do as humans today.
Yes.
Whereas Starfleet, these people are living in this idealistic society, and we're always seeing these crews on these starships where there's all this structure and they're there to uphold the ideals that they've been taught in the academy. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're out there in space. And here we see a bit more of it turns a mirror on us, shines a light on us in a way that TNG didn't necessarily do so often before that.
Right.
While we're talking about the booby trap, I did want to talk a little bit about the dialogue, because when you hear it, I remember when you watch it for the first time, you're caught off guard. Like, wait, what did he say? What's going on? And then the dialogue sounds a bit silly a lot of the time, like we were doing at the beginning of the episode here today. But Michael McGreevy, who wrote the episode, he talked in the Deep Space Nine magazine about back in the day about writing this and how he approached it. And just as a creative myself, as a creative professional and as a writer, I thought it was interesting that he said that at first he was just writing gibberish, but he realized that he couldn't do that because the idea of what the virus is doing is it's creating this disconnect. It's explained in the episode, actually, where you see a tricorder and you say something ridiculous like window.
Right.
There's a dialogue in the episode. Right. And so to make it actually have some realism to it, you have to represent that there's actually a disconnect happening and the person is trying to say something. Like, they know what they're trying to say, but it's coming out in a way that doesn't make sense. And so there has to be some actual... It's not that the sentence needs to make sense, but that the word association isn't there.
Yes.
And so he said that he actually would write these things out, and then he would say them out loud, and he put the real meaning of the sentence in parentheses next to the confused aphasic language that he had written. And also what was interesting is that he put the real meaning of the sentence next to the gibberish, I'm doing air quotes here, that he was writing, but keeping the same rhythm to it. That I thought was really interesting, that it's not completely random. There's a lot of thought process going on creatively behind the writing of this to try to create this parallel rhythm to it.
Well, and I think the cool thing about this is that, you know, this is actually something that happens with people that have different types of brain injuries. This can actually happen in real life. Mm-hmm. So the idea of aphasia is not just a Star Trek idea. And so I think the terrifying nature of that, of, you know, not being able to be understood, is very scary, you know. And obviously the reason why the title Babel fits so well is because, you know, that's the biblical story, is the Tower of Babel, where everybody, you know, all of a sudden is speaking a completely different language, and how terrifying that would be and isolating that would be. And that's exactly what happens here in the episode.
Which reminds me of my alternate solution to the problem, which is if Quark had just conveniently been receiving a shipment of Babel fish at the time that this happened, and then
would have been fine.
Everyone could just shove one in their ear and go about their business.
Yeah. Yeah. So, no, I agree with you. This is, I think, you know, the way in which it's portrayed too comes across on screen with the actors all doing a really good job of, you can tell these people believe what they're saying, and then they realize that nobody can understand them. So, and that's, I mean, again, what a terrifying place to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's talk about Jadzia a little bit, because this is something that you mentioned to me in this episode, where we're continuing the growth of her character, which we've seen through the first few episodes of the season here. And we've asked the question in our recent discussions about why she puts up with Julian, and this juxtaposition of their real ages of the symbiont and Julian, like the life knowledge that Dax has and that Bashir has. And you had some thoughts on how it's portrayed here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing is that we start off the episode with Jadzia and Kira walking down the promenade, and she's talking about the difference that it is to be back in a female body and forgetting what it was like to have all the attention, especially, you know, we know that she's a beautiful woman and she likes the attention. She mentions that in the episode, is that she finds that pleasing. And so I think it really does help answer the question as to why she allows Julian to kind of pursue her. There's a big part of her that enjoys that she has that effect on him and that he is pursuant of her. And I think that what that does then for the show is that it creates a very peculiar arc to kind of play out with those two characters as mm-hmm. we move forward. And, you know, it's one that's going to be so much more nuanced and so much more interesting than we ever thought possible, you know, especially when all the way down the road, she's going to confess to him that, you know, if it hadn't been Worf, it would have been him. Mm-hmm. And so to get to that place from here is such an incredibly interesting thing. But I think more than anything, what it goes to show is that I don't know many people who don't enjoy the thought that people think that they're good looking. So it just adds this really fascinating layer to this character who, you know, last week we talked about the idea of, like, you know, she's trying to tell Julian about the differences and how they approach things. But there's this other side of her that's like, yeah, I just kind of like the attention. It's nice.
Yeah. Well, I think for her, it's a newness because, for one thing, she was female in past hosts. And she says now it's been like 80 years since I was a woman. And so there's this newness again of getting attention in a way that she didn't as Curzon. But I think also, like, as a show and with the writing, they're able to show that, you know, different people react in different ways to the same situation. And so you see in Kira someone who would be bothered by that attention. But with Jadzia, she actually welcomes it. And I, again, think in real life that even though often these days the atmosphere is like it's always bad, no attention, but not everyone feels that way, and that's another case of Deep Space Nine showing the diversity of real life and how different people react. But also, like, I do know people who get very bothered by the feeling that, you know, people are finding them to be attractive, or at mm-hmm. least outwardly they would push them away. And I think that a lot of that is because it's not that they don't appreciate that, but they don't want that to feel superficial, like that's the only thing someone sees in them. And we've already seen it portrayed in these first episodes of Deep Space Nine that that's not the case with Julian and Jadzia, because they both are very intelligent and knowledgeable scientists. We've seen them work together to find solutions. And so that's a case where maybe Jadzia is enjoying that because she also knows that there is this connection. Like, she and Bashir share the scientific, intellectual knowledge and curiosity as well. And that may be a part of it.
Right. And I think that's the thing here, is that Jadzia has the agency in this show. I don't ever feel as though she couldn't tell Julian to stop and
right.
he would not comply.
Yeah. Right.
And so that's the thing. And it's one of the things to which we kind of learn about the character as she moves forward throughout the seasons, is that she becomes even more open. You know, we learn about the fact that she's very open mm-hmm. with herself relationally, sexually.
Which makes perfect sense for her many lives as a joined trill, right?
Right. So that's something, again, to which, exactly what you said, for some people that they would be bothered by this. For her as a person, she's not. And to they allow her, again, to be able to have that agency, to be able to, again, to feel as though she could always say no. But here, I think specifically, the writers are kind of explaining themselves to say she is a character who for her, she enjoys this, and therefore that's why she's allowing it to continue. Mm-hmm. If she didn't enjoy it, like Kira, she would tell you, you know, like when Kira's like, if you don't get that hand off hip, you'll never be able to use it again. So, you know, that's the difference between these two characters. So what they're saying is that in this show, you can be either one of these women, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
other characters we see growing in this story, Cork and Odo, I think the friendship and the professional collaboration that Renee and Armin had before Deep Space Nine continues to really shine through here in the way that Cork and Odo interact with each other. Great job establishing that while they're sort of the cop and robber relationship, where Odo is the law enforcement, Cork's the one always doing something shady or behind the scenes, but yet they have this bond. You see Odo stand up for Cork, and that shines through. And then Cork himself, and Armin said this about this episode, actually, that he felt like this is the moment where he starts finding the Cork character. And I also get that sense here as well.
Yeah, I think that this is one of the things that is really special about the show, is that already what we see here is an immense amount of nuance. And the relationship between Cork and Odo is so multifaceted. They have this love-hate relationship that, here, I think you get a sense of the amount of respect mm-hmm. that there actually is for one another. And it specifically comes out in that scene where Odo talks about the fact that he doesn't know how to play Dabo.
Yeah, right.
And Quark's like, I'll teach you how to play. In fact, I won't ever tell anybody that you know that I taught, you know. So there's this moment there when nobody else is around. Literally no one mm-hmm. there on the promenade. Everybody's, you know, locked up in their homes like COVID hit.
Right.
And it's this genuine moment where when they don't have to pretend like they're enemies, mm-hmm. they're more like frenemies.
Yeah.
And that's something that then just continues to play out throughout the series.
Well, it carries through until one of the final scenes of the series, right?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. That man loves me. right. You know, and it really is. I think as I was watching this episode, you know, you could probably say this episode's a little bit silly and whatever, but there are so many little pieces that play into the rest of the whole mm-hmm. and literally to the end of the series, like you just said, mm-hmm. where an episode like this, especially when you're doing the rewatch, you see those building blocks that they're giving you. And that's just so much fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the Siskos as well, you know, Ben and Jake here, what really just screams out at you from the screen when Benjamin goes to the infirmary and hugs Jake is how real that feels. Like that's not acting like, okay, you should go in and you need to hug Jake. He's your son. That was like Avery hugging Sirach. You can just feel it all the way through. And mm-hmm. that comes through right here at the start. And again, not only carries through the whole series, but even through to today between the two of them.
Yes. Yeah. No, I 100% agree. I think that was every little moment, I think, matters in this episode, and it goes into the portrayal of, you know, these characters, and it's one of the things that I love about doing the rewatch is you can see how much that they have been putting into the characters even from the beginning, which is actually pretty astounding.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, for us, this isn't like our first rewatch or anything. This is, I don't know how many, you know, dozens of rewatches, right? But even for us, these moments still pop out. They pop off the screen early on.
Yep.
So Another thing we could talk about is how life on the station is settling in from what we saw in Emissary, where the station's a wreck and they're having to bring bunks off the Enterprise and they're trying to get stuff set up. Then after that, we saw Keiko start a school. Things are trying to settle in. Quark is becoming a community leader. And yet life on the station still feels quite chaotic.
You know, one of the things that really did stand out to me was the fact that this series has really stayed consistent with itself so far, mm-hmm. without necessarily feeling overly serialized. But we knew from the first episode in Emissary that the Cardassians had pretty much laid waste to this station and had really done a lot of damage to all of the systems. So when we come into this episode and that the fact that O'Brien is being run ragged and so is his team because everything keeps breaking on the station is such a wonderful connection to what the show has already set up, again, without over-serialized nature to it. And this is the thing I think that even in the first season, I know that the writers here specifically, I was just watching a round table that Terry Metalis was a part of, but then Brendan Braga was a part of, and Robert Hewitt Wolf, and all of these people who have worked on all of the versions of Star Trek. And Robert was talking about this idea is that, yeah, when we came into Deep Space Nine, they didn't want serialization, but it just kind of started to happen, basically. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the ways in which I think that's coming into play. It's like the writer knew, oh, yeah, well, we kind of did this thing. And now to come in and have, you know, O'Brien just be, you know, running his tail off trying to fix things really makes sense. And two, I mean, it gives me one of my favorite moments in all of Deep Space Nine was when Miles just snaps at Sisko in a way that he would never, ever have gotten away with Picard.
You call him Sassy yet, Miles, right?
It is Miles. I mean, we got Miles sass.
Miles and Miles of and sass. That's what we got.
Miles and Miles of sass. Yes. But there's, but I think what that does is that it shows you just how run down Miles is, so that's the immediate reaction. And then he's just kind of like, oh, what did I just say? And, you know, Sisko lets it go, and again, in a way that I don't know if Picard ever would have. And part of that is I think he's really living with the character. I mean, as a commander, he's intricately involved in these guys' lives in a way that Picard isn't.
Right.
Because he's there with them, seeing what they're doing. And so, like, the whole scene and the whole thing is just a testament to, I think, what this show is already doing well, and we're four episodes in.
Yeah, right. Well, think about how many crew members aboard the Enterprise never interact with Picard at all. And if they ever do get close to him, it's like, wow, the captain, right? So Sisko is not like that at all. He's always mingling with everyone by necessity, but also I think by personality. I can't picture Sisko as being someone who would just hang out in his office or hang out in ops and not actually get out and get to know people.
Well, and I think part of that comes from the fact is that we'll realize later, you know, who his father was, and he picked up so many of the habits from his father. I think, you know, in many ways, Sisko would probably have been like a chef like his dad, because I think he does enjoy people in that way. And we obviously see him sharing his love of cooking and having people over to his quarters that are on the team. And there's something, I think he's just a much more relationally driven person. And I think that there's a real beauty in that, because I think that that's also very appropriate for an African-American man,
mm-hmm.
right? I think that that's, and you know, maybe that's not for me to say, but it just, when I see those communities, and I've been in those communities, mm-hmm. you know, I've been able to visit a few African-American churches yeah. and those kind of things. And I've, you know, they're so relationally focused with one another
yep.
in that
it's
way.
It's like
right?
family, right? And they're very welcoming.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, I have,
exactly.
you know, friends. And yeah, it's like you're part of the family. Yep. So, yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like that really does play into the characterization of, mm-hmm. of Sisko. And that's also, I think, just something that Avery Brooks immediately brings out in his portrayal, which is one of the beauties of what he was trying to do. He, you know, he's talked many a times about how he was very cognizant of that he was the first black captain, mm-hmm. And he was the representational as well of black fatherhood mm-hmm. and manhood on this show. And he took that very seriously. And I think what we see here of him is something that he should be very proud of because of the way he represents not just what should happen for black people, right? But I think he represents a beauty and relationship that everyone should strive for.
Right.
And that's what I think makes him my favorite captain, is he's really, in many ways, the most human of all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and it perfectly captures the spirit of Star Trek, because that's what Star Trek is supposed to be at its core, is that we're
yeah, yeah.
we're shedding those categories. It doesn't matter, you know, what color or even species you happen to be here on the
yeah,
station.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Right.
Yep.
I mean, that's,
yeah.
you know.
We're all in this together.
Yeah.
We're really not as different as you know, the outside might make us look,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, and that's...
And then finding where those differences, you know, where yeah, it's just, it's so great.
Yeah, and Sisko, you know, he became my favorite captain as well. He just, you know, he creates this sense of community and family here. Not just among a crew of people who are all on the same mission, but a group of people who are from so many different backgrounds, and still they all must live together in this community.
It's interesting to me because, you know, juxtaposing that against what happens in Voyager,
mm-hmm.
I think that one of the beauties of Deep Space Nine is that they do and are allowed to keep the tension there mm-hmm. between characters like, say, Sisko and Kira, mm-hmm. because they're always going to have some more major differences.
Right.
And yet they find a way to work together that feels more natural and real in that sense, because it doesn't shy away from the fact that, yeah, they're always going to be some major differences, right? But we also find a way to overcome those. And so I think that's something that makes this show special, because we really have, in many ways, the most diverse cast when it comes to the cultures that they're coming from, that are trying to find a way to live in some kind of harmony together on this wagon wheel in the stars.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. Yeah, it is a wagon wheel in the stars. Exactly. With a big spoke sticking out, right?
Yes, exactly.
you mentioned Sisko's dad and cooking and being a chef. And of course, we do see Sisko cooking on the show, which gave me an idea for a Star Trek spinoff, since these days we're just making as many Star Trek TV series as possible. Instead of Master Chef, what do you think about Astral Chef, where Sisko, Pike, and Riker all get together and create dishes using whatever ingredients have been chosen for the day?
I mean, you feel like you might want to add Kirk to that, because we know Kirk likes to cook too.
That's true.
So,
Kirk, he's going to be
fantastic.
Anything with eggs, he's going to be on that. Yeah.
Yeah, a little dill,
yeah.
you know? So, I mean, maybe he's got Bones' recipe for beans too, so you never know.
Oh, yeah. And just think of all the marshmallows that we can eat as well.
And the secret ingredient. So
looking forward to that. All right. Well, let's wrap up with some final thoughts here. We get to the end of the episode. They find a solution. Of course, Kira finds the scientist and basically has to force him to help by infecting him, which I guess we could do another episode on the ethics of that. But anyway, she brings him to the station and he manages to rather quickly solve the problem for someone who had very little to do with the creation of the virus. But I don't think that the resolution of the story was really the whole point of the episode in the first place.
Well, so I did want to mention something there because I felt like that actually showed me how close Julian had got and gave us an insight to the genius of Julian. More so than it did necessarily that scientist, because he looks at Julian's research and is easily able to put the pieces together, because it seems like Julian was almost there.
He was almost
there. So that was, but on a whole, you know, I think this is just a really solid, good episode to me. I love the character interactions that we get. I really enjoy the way in which the show is taking itself like seriously. It's setting where it is, and that necessitates a different type of storytelling than we've gotten in Star Trek previously to this. And I think this show shows the way in which they're embracing it. And so I'm going to give this 4 out of 5 Babelfish.
All right. Excellent. Yeah. I think you summed things up pretty well. I think it's a silly episode on the surface. It's one I've always enjoyed, though. It's one I've often rewatched when I want to rewatch. It's kind of like when I want to rewatch, I want to put some Star Trek on. I don't want a heavy story like we get later on in this series. I just want something light and fun. And so often I'll put TNG episodes on or original series episodes. But from DS9, this is one that I would put on. But once you really delve into it like we have here, you can see these other layers underneath that surface silliness. And it's another strong episode for character building and helping the series find its footing, even if it is an idea that had been kicked around for 5 years on The Next Generation before finally being put to screen here. So I'm going to give this one 8 pigs flying low over fields of pork.
Delicious.
which means something totally different than what I was thinking, of course. But it's still 8 anyway. All right, everyone. We would love to hear your thoughts on Babel. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts. So if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. It is a closed group just for listeners. And to find it, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, in the search field. If it doesn't come right up, just type the whole name, the Babel Conference. You'll see a post for this episode on the timeline, and you can share your comments with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. And if you'd like to send us email, you can do that. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there, choose to send to a show, and choose the orb, and that will come to us by email. And also, you can find us in social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Let us know what you think about the show and let other potential listeners decide if they want to listen to The Orb. And we thank everyone who has reviewed and rated the show. Well, Matthew, when you're not having a cup of black double sweet coffee, where can people find you?
I always think that he loves the double sweet. I do not love ultra sweet coffee, so every time he says it, I'm like, ugh.
Me neither. But you remember in Rascals, he gets black double sweet coffee as well. So that's actually a tie-in to TNG.
Yes, he does. Yeah. Well, you can find me all over the place on social media under the name MattRushing02. Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero are the places I'm most active. You can also find me, of course, here on the network and the 602 Club, talking about all of the fans we love under one roof. It is a great place to be. I hope you'll check that out. We have a blast over there. And Literary Treks, talking about the books and the comics of Star Trek. Warp 5, Chris, you and I are doing the 20th anniversary rewatch, which has been a lot of fun. You can also find us doing Saddle Up about Strange New Worlds. And, Chris, did you know next week is the premiere of Star Trek Picard Season 3, which means Artificial Tango is already back because we got a new episode out for everybody.
Yeah, we've already put out a preview episode getting ready for Season 3, and then we'll be running through the season as it plays out week by week like we did last time. So looking forward to that.
Yeah, it's going to be so much fun. And then over on the Nerd Party Network, I've got a show about Harry Potter called Owl Post. I did that with Dre Kaufman. And then you can also find me on Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills as we talk about Star Wars each and every week. But Chris, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter mainly. That's where I'm most active. But my username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. I'm also on Mastodon now, and it's still C. Brian Jones there, but I'm on the Trekkies.social instance of Mastodon if you want to look me up over there on the Elephant app. And when I'm not busy chatting in social media, you can find me elsewhere on the network here. Of course, doing all those shows, Matthew, with you that you mentioned. Larry Nemechek and I do The Ready Room, and you can find me on many episodes in the back catalog. And I'd love for you to check those out, and then let me know what you think in social media. And if you'd like to help us keep this show and everything that we're doing going, we could really use your help. If you want to find out how to get involved in the network, even become an associate producer of these rewatches we're doing, you can find out how to do that on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And I'd like to send a huge thank you to everyone who's supporting us right now. We absolutely would not be here without your help. So thank you very, very much. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to our next episode. And I really just have one word for you where that's concerned. Tusk.
Well, Chris, I can't wait to get to a little Tusk. But we do want to thank everybody for joining us. And we will see them next time as we gaze into the orb.